I'm privileged to be where I am now. I've worked very hard for it. They bankrupted me a number of times. So you've got to have the resilience to come back. When you see and understand what they can do, even to my wonderful colleagues in medicine, they spoil them. They destroy them completely. You go through 6 years of primary school, 6 years of secondary school, 6 years of university, medical school, then another 4 years specialising. By the end of it, you're like I was, completely naive to the reality of life. You don't know really what's going on in the systems that are so utterly corrupted.
Hello and welcome to You're the Voice. I am Efrat Fenningson, and today I have the honor of interviewing Professor Ian Brighthope at his beautiful house in Melbourne, Australia. Professor Brighthope's lifelong ambition is to help change the way medicine and healthcare is practiced for the benefit of the public and to see nutritional, herbal, and environmental medicine become the building blocks to world health and peace. Ian is an award-winning therapist and entrepreneur, and I got to know him in the past couple of years during COVID, as I bumped into some very brave dissident voices on our Twitter spaces. Ian is just a bit older than me, having graduated in agriculture science in 1965 and then in 1974 with a Bachelor of Medicine and a Bachelor of Surgery. Ian founded or led various clinics, schools, councils, and many initiatives around integrative and natural medicine for the past 45 years. I actually had a very long list of names of organizations that he helped establish or established himself, but I'll keep that in the show notes for you to see, and we'll talk about some of these organizations as we go along this episode. So thanks for being with me. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you very much, Efrat. Thank you for the invitation to speak with you.
Thank you for taking the time to be with me while I'm here. And this is a great surprise for both of us that we could put this episode together. So thank you so much to your team as well for helping us do that.
You're most welcome. We've got a fantastic team.
So maybe we'll start with you introducing yourself a bit more to our audience and telling us a bit your approach to integrative medicine and a bit about your background.
Of course, when I left school, I went and studied agricultural science. So I became a scientist and did a couple of years animal research, animal nutrition, and work in the teaching area as well. And then I decided to do medicine and graduated in 1974, having been frustrated by the undergraduate course. There was no teaching about nutrition, no teaching about healthcare or human productivity and reproductivity. It was all about drugs, surgery, pathology, tests, and looking after the sick, which is fine. But treating the sick is one part of healthcare. Making them healthy is very important. And back in my ag science days, I learned that animals are looked after very well. We supplement them when we want to have reproductive cycles improved or productivity improved. We supplement them with grains and supplements and salt licks and vitamins, etc., so that they are more productive. But we don't do that with people in hospital or people who are sick. Unfortunately, where there's no what we call husbandry, back in the good old days, animal husbandry, sheep husbandry, cattle husbandry, there's none of that when you're treating sick people. Basically, I was told in fourth year medicine that when I asked my prof about the sick person in the bed, a little old lady with cancer, who was being fed salt and sugar solutions intravenously and ice cream and jelly for dinner. I asked about her nutritional status and I was told, we're not worried about this person's diet. We are treating the cancer in the bed. And so this was a shock to me. And my colleagues around, you know, the junior doctors in the hospital at this time was shocking. And I said, I'm not going to be a doctor like you. That was, I said to myself.
That was it.
That was it. Bang. I was going to do something different. And it took me a long time to figure out exactly what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It took some travel around the world, some ship's doctoring, visiting some very unusual places in South America and in the islands and all around the world, looking for alternative ways of treating people. Mm-hmm. So I came back.
Were you exposed to how other places are doing it? Did it give you inspiration?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean,
in what kind of places?
In the islands, in Vanuatu, going out and looking at the power of the mind in certain places where people were challenged to do something and they couldn't do it, but it was such a simple thing to do. For example, fish poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
They wrapped the very sick patient up in banana leaves. And that patients get better. They don't need anything else. It reminds me of the old approach to mastitis, in the breast inflammation abscess in lactating females.
Mm-hmm.
You get a cabbage leaves and wrap them around the breast.
Uh-huh.
And that helps to heal the breast.
I did that.
You did?
Yes. I had to because it was so painful.
Yeah.
And my mom said, you got to do that.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
She said, do it. Do You'll it. Thank me. And
yeah.
it worked.
Yeah.
I was very surprised.
Yes, yes. And I mean, it doesn't matter what size the breast, you can always find a cabbage leaf that will help it.
That's right.
Okay?
This is my... big enough nothing to help it.
This is part of my teaching. I saw serious burns in Brazil and watched them take the aloe vera gel and smear it over the patient.
Yes.
A far superior treatment to what we do here with silver sulfidiazine and all the antibiotics, because the aloe vera is nutritional as well as anti-inflammatory and reduces the adverse effects of the inflammation. Unbelievable. So I decided that there were molecules in nature that are going to heal people. Not only molecules in nature that make animals more reproductive, but healing. And it's an absolute reality. I loved soil science, and soil science got so many microbes in there. It's a microbiome. We're only now starting to learn about our gut and the microbiome in our gut.
I had a wonderful episode with Dr. Sabine Hazen.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And we talked a lot about the microbiome.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It is. It is.
It's a whole world.
Yeah.
And we're just scratching the surface,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can influence your microbiome with an apple. You can influence your microbiome by swallowing an antidepressant.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that, and it's as complex as that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got a healthy microbiome, you're going to live for a nice long period of time. If you wipe your microbiome out completely, take antibiotics and kill every bug in your system, you're going to die within a very short period of time. That was my experience in early days in hospitals. And shortly after, when I returned back to Australia, I decided I was going to do something different, and I decided to set up a clinic dealing in nutritional medicine. Environmental medicine came later.
Was that in the 80s?
That was in the late 70s. So it was a challenge because they all said, oh, you'll be back in our clinics because you won't be seeing any patients. They don't want that sort of thing. In 6 months, I had a six-month waiting list. I had access to four hospitals. And I was on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for many, many years. I was very, very fortunate. I've been very, very lucky and privileged. I don't like the word privileged, but I was. I had the opportunities to do the things that I felt were important for people in clinic as well as in hospital. I had anaesthetic rounds, and I was still giving anaesthetics. And at the end of my anaesthetics, I'd pump in some vitamin C and some B vitamins and some magnesium and zinc and or whatever I thought the patient needed. Patients would wake up before they got to recovery room. These patients virtually never, ever had wounds that didn't heal, wounds that got infected. No thrombosis. When you look at the nutrients and the building blocks that I was injecting into them, these things are anti-inflammatory, they're anti-thrombotic, they're anti-hemorrhagic, they're anti-carcinogenic, but more importantly, they are anti-infective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, vitamin C, for example, stimulates the immune system, but it also has an adverse effect on bacteria, viruses, and fungi. So the observations that you make as a clinician are so important, Efrat. Science is very important, and looking at large studies is very important as well. But you've got to be able to translate the basic sciences, the observations you have, mix them up with the information you get from the scientific literature, and make sense of it, rather than just work on a protocol. Because
these are the boots on the ground.
These are the boots on the ground, yeah. And we do need to follow protocols. It's very important for the safety of everybody and to be effective as clinicians. It's like a fellow who flew his plane into the Hudson River. He took off from an airport, I think it was New York somewhere. He flew into a flock of birds, and he had a couple of hundred people on the plane, and the birds, he shut down both engines. So the plane was basically a glider, and he had to decide whether he's going to glide back to the airport or glide into the Hudson River. Mm-hmm. He assessed the situation and didn't follow protocol and flew into the Hudson River, landed there, and the passengers all survived. Nobody died. But he was heavily criticized because he didn't follow protocol. But this is what happens when you've got patience and you've done everything you possibly can and you follow the protocols. You've got to take some risk with a patient and say, well, what can I do to help this person survive? And I've been there and done that with seriously ill patients in intensive care, for example, where they're dying and there's nothing else that medicine can do. Medicine should be doing something beforehand, but a few nutrients, powerful nutrients given intravenously, can actually reverse that patient's track on death. And you can actually reverse a pathological process that's going to result in end of life.
So that leads me to what you have experimented with and done successfully during the 80s with the HIV. Can you share a bit about that? I know this was a big milestone in your career and in your life because of what happened as a result of that.
Yes, Efrat, that changed my life. It changed the whole direction of my career. My life was basically... In the early 80s, with the advent of the HIV/AIDS virus, I was happily practicing my nutritional medicine. I was happily practicing my anesthetics and doing a bit of both orthodox and non-orthodox work. I was giving high doses of intravenous vitamin C to patients who were suffering from a whole range of conditions, including infectious disease, mostly infectious disease, acute viral infections, herpes, glandular fever, mononucleosis, shingles, all of these viral infections respond extremely well to high-dose intravenous vitamin C if the viral infection is going on. One young lass, she's a daughter of a friend of mine, still alive and well, 21-year-old came in with adult chickenpox all over her body, right down into her lungs, right down into her gut.
Wow.
She could hardly speak. She could hardly breathe. And when you see there's no other medicine that's available in Western medicine that will do anything like what I saw with her. I gave her some intravenous vitamin C. Within 2 hours, the pox were drying up.
Within two hours.
And she was getting free of pain. I said, I'll go out to the hospital and be admitted, because I wanted to be admitted. And the next morning she walked in. She said, I'm drinking and I'm swallowing and I'm breathing easily and I'm feeling much better. So I gave her some more IV vitamins and that was it. Adult chickenpox can kill very quickly by causing a pneumonia. So I knew what I was doing with the high-dose intravenous vitamin C. And I had a patient come in from the US who was a lecturer here in Melbourne University. He was gay. He had full-blown AIDS, Kaposi sarcoma, which is the cancer of the skin, the black.
Yes.
Black, a black cancer to take over the skin. And he said, can you give me some of your treatment? I'm getting these infections. So we started giving him the high-dose intravenous vitamin C, and his opportunistic infections dropped down in terms of frequency and severity and eventually stopped. And, of course, the gay population heard about it, so I had a whole stream of people.
Word of mouth, they came to you. And you started treating them?
Yep. It was word of mouth. And at the time, we were just starting the College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine. I was writing a book on nutritional and environmental medicine. The co-author was a book for the public, not for the profession. The chapter on the immune system, he said, look, let's turn this into a book on AIDS. So I did. And as a consequence of that, there was a lot of interest, television, radio, interviews all over the place. That upset the Medical Board of Victoria. Very much.
Did it upset only Australia or also globally?
Well, it didn't upset anybody in the US. I did a trip to the US and spoke about it in the US. HIV AIDS groups over there were very interested in it. One of Elizabeth Taylor's groups were very interested. She set up a place in Tijuana in Mexico for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very interested. And I gave a talk to a very large audience in Universal City. Then after that, the doctors over there started using it as well. Because I think I was one of the first. There was another guy over there who was doing a little bit, but not to the extent that we were doing it here. Because I had a whole clinic devoted to treating HIV and AIDS and cancer and AIDS patients. So
here they didn't like it that much.
Here they didn't like it at all. And I thought I was doing something good for the community and very naive. Extremely naive about what was going on. I was told, Ian, you're doing the wrong thing. Go back into medicine. You get into trouble. I remember in one of the hospitals, and I wrote about this in a recent Substack, I was called a quack, and I really redefined the word quack. That really means quality care with kindness, if you flick it up. I was called all sorts of names. There was a certain amount of envy there because nearly 50% of one of the hospitals contained my patients, not the HIV patients, but patients with other serious mm-hmm. inflammatory disorders, bowel disorders, diabetes, etc. And they're all nearly all responding to fasting and nutritional rebalancing and IV nutrients. But the medical board didn't like any of the things I was doing. I'd already been before the board a few times because I'd been reported by doctors who said he's taken somebody off a drug that he shouldn't have, or he's, you know, and I never ever do that. And I never did that unless the patient wanted it, unless the patient was fully informed, and I had something to treat as an alternative. Yeah. And that's what we did. So they charged me under Section 17. Of the Medical Boards Act in Victoria, which was a charges of infamous conduct in a professional respect. Infamy is a pretty nasty name. It's something that's referred to doctors who
commit crimes,
yeah. Interfere with their patients and do serious things. And all my crime was 20 charges, over 20 charges, I think, of infamous conduct in a professional respect, because they went through the book and they charged me for anything that I said that was detrimental to the profession or making what they thought were false claims. I was investigated. I was interrogated by some pretty nasty barristers, but I was fortunate because I had a friend in the legal profession who had a barrister, who had a QC, the Queen's Counsel. Being the son of the governor, was very much a part of the establishment, mm-hmm. but he read my book and he thought, there is a good case for defending me rather than the medical board attacking me. And this particular senior counsel was also the QC that worked for the medical board in the past in other cases. So he understood their operations. After a number of days in the witness box and you know, very stressful period, they had to drop the charges of infamous conduct and just make it professional misconduct so they couldn't strike me off. Because he's shown that they should not have charged me under Section 17 for writing a book, and they accused me of advertising.
And do you think that has given you some kind of a lesson about naivete, about the establishment and their...
I certainly lost my innocence.
What do you think they wanted to achieve?
Well, we'd started the College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, and I was the president. I was the founding president. And that was in the very early days, a couple of years old we were. We're now 45 years old mm-hmm. and very successful. They said, you're never going to have nutritional medicine as a specialty. They wanted to make an example of me and frighten me and strike me off so that the college would not succeed.
I want to bring that experience to what we've experienced in the past few years with COVID and the response of the Victoria government and Australia in general and the world to this thing called COVID. I'll start by just simply asking you, do you think COVID was a pandemic?
It was a pandemic of fear. an absolute pandemic of medical mismanagement, not only recently, but over the last number of generations, and a complete lack of real healthcare for the entire community. And I'm talking about industrialized, westernized nations.
Mm-hmm.
Have no idea about what they've done to the health of the human population, filling us up with sugar, white flour products, alcohol, a whole range of chemicals in our food chain, ultra-highly processed foods, empty-calorie foods, foods without levels of nutrients that are going to protect us against cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, autoimmune diseases, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
We are living in a very imbalanced way, and that's not only from our physical perspective, our psychological and spiritual as well.
Yes.
And the damage that I think the elites have done for the purposes of making money, control, power, and maintaining their station in life, which is keeping all of us as unhealthy slaves in systems that we should not be living in. Yes, I'm privileged to be where I am now. I've worked very hard for it. They bankrupted me a number of times, so you've got to have the resilience to come back when you see and understand what they can do. Even to my wonderful colleagues in medicine, they spoil them, they destroy mm-hmm. them completely. You go through 6 years of primary school, 6 years of secondary school, 6 years of university, medical school, then another 4 years specializing. By the end of it, you're like I was, completely naive to the reality of life. You don't know really what's going on
mm-hmm.
in the systems that are so utterly corrupted. We now know how corrupt our governments are here in Australia. Many of us are starting to realise. But the young people, they can't afford a home. There are people sleeping in the streets. There are drug addicts who are not looked after. It is shameful. And my profession has been responsible for a lot of it because it has not spoken up. And it's not spoken up because of a number of reasons. There's ignorance, there's arrogance, there's willful approaches by some in the profession, and it's the leaders in the profession who have been bought off and destroy the rest of the profession. The senior sales for the drug companies are our professors.
So I want to quote from your response to the COVID inquiry. I recently read that on your Substack. You wrote, "The government's attempts to balance public safety with individual freedoms and economic concerns were not always successful. Lockdowns and border closures, while thought necessary to control the spread of the virus, had a significant negative impact on individual liberties and businesses. Health professionals were forbidden to provide informed consent, and the public were forcibly coerced into taking an experimental and unsafe vaccine." This is just one small part of your response to the COVID inquiry. So can you tell me a bit about the COVID inquiry and what's the process, and also your mission to hold a royal commission? I saw that that's something you're passionate about.
Yes. Well, I think the COVID inquiry is going to be a whitewash, actually, because our Prime Minister should be aware of the effects of the actions of the health authorities, and that is the overuse of this mRNA toxic vaccine wrapped up in a lipid nanoparticle, which is highly inflammatory, getting into the brain of people and having an adverse effect on individuals. So going back to the Prime Minister, he has received letters from me, and I know he's received them because they've gone by certified mail.
Yes.
And he's done nothing.
Ignored it.
Mm-hmm. I also think he's compromised. I think he's had private conversations with the ultra vaccinator, Mr. William Henry Gates. And I think he and the Attorney General, who's also received letters, and the Health Minister currently, part of a system that is wanting to continue with the corruption that we've witnessed in the past with previous governments. So I don't think this inquiry is going to reveal very much at all. He has selected his own people, three people, one of them being one of the epidemiologists who very much ran the show amongst the other epidemiologists. And I might mention that their modelling has been absolutely disgraceful. So much unscientific modelling I've never ever seen in my life. I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not a modeller, but I do understand that if you don't put certain criteria into modelling, you're going to get the answer that you want. And that was basically, we're going to lock everybody down, make sure that we get control of everybody. With a pandemic that was not a pandemic, it was a plandemic, as you know, event 201, I think it was, October
2019.
A month later, we've got a virus. The dress rehearsal was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the ability now to frighten us to the point where we will comply. So we've put in submissions to the inquiry.
Yes.
I did personally, and I did for the World of Wellness International, which is one of the other organisations that we've got here now.
Yeah.
And also the Australian Medical Professional Society, which is the alternative to the AMA, the group of awakened doctors.
Mm-hmm.
There are more awakened doctors joining all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we will go to the inquiry. I'll act as a witness. I've put my arguments in.
You don't put your hopes up?
I don't put, no.
And so what's the Royal Commission?
The Royal Commission is a far greater opportunity. I think you're going to be talking to Malcolm Roberts, one of our senators.
Correct.
Very much on side.
Mm-hmm.
As there are other senators who are awake and knowledgeable about the damage that this vaccine is doing to the Australian community and the rest of the world.
We're calling it vaccine just for the sake of it, but we know it's not a vaccine.
We know it's not a vaccine. And I've looked at all of the vaccines now, and we now know that a lot of these vaccines are either useless or they're causing adverse effects. And there's been no real studies on most of the childhood vaccines, no good studies to show that they are actually preventing the diseases. We know that there is an increased risk of these children developing epilepsy, asthma, eczema, autoimmune diseases, perhaps even childhood diabetes, etc., etc.
Autism.
Oh, please.
I'm not supposed to say that, right? I would recommend people to buy and read the book Turtles All the Way Down.
Yes.
And maybe RFK's book as well.
Yes.
About vaccines.
Vaccines, yes.
Sorry.
Definitely. I endorse both of those books. Recommend them. Also, Too Many Dead is another book that the AMPS group have put together. The Royal Commission has been put together by some wonderful lawyers here. You can see them on my Substack,
mm-hmm.
or in the Royal Commission submission that we've put in.
I signed.
Great, thank you.
I'm an Australian citizen.
Yeah, you can sign.
Yes, I did.
But the submission is...
We will also have a link to it in this episode so people can go and sign.
Yeah, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Because the Royal Commission will allow us to present the truth and the evidence. Royal Commissions can't make decisions about what sort of actions should be taken afterwards. Mm. But once the Royal Commission has got all of the evidence, and the evidence is profound, the failure in prevention, vitamin C, vitamin D and zinc, right from the start, the failure of early treatment, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and some of the other natural antiviral herbal medicines should have been used. But what do? Tell people to go home, get sick, and if you get sick enough, go to hospital. And when you go to hospital, you don't get the right treatment anyway. So I think we've got to go through this Royal Commission, and after that, we will see the civil litigation. We have seen the damage done to our somatic cells from this poison, and we've seen the poison going into the germ cells, the testicles and the ovaries, the production of sperm and egg. We know that the lipid nanoparticle will take the RNA, and there's also contamination from DNA into the genome of individuals. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we certainly know it's having an effect on reproductive cycles. Females, we know it's having an effect on fertility, and we know it's having an effect on survival of embryos and fetus.
You've mentioned on the podcast of Dr. Ahmed Malik that you had a chat with Dr. Robert Malone. What do you think about his stand today?
Shortly after, I did an interview with one of our top immunologists,
yeah.
And we were talking about the efficacy of the vaccines. And we were talking about mRNA, and I basically said, look, mRNA is a failed technology.
Mm-hmm.
It was never shown to have an effect on any serious illness or disease in humans up until 2019. And at 2019, 2020, we start thinking about mRNA as a so-called vaccine. And it's not a vaccine. It doesn't stimulate antibodies like normal vaccines do. And normal vaccines don't stimulate all the right antibodies anyway. That's why they don't work very well. Why use this technology? Well, because the technology is so fantastic, we can actually design a spike protein that's not like or not identical to the virus's spike protein, but we can design a spike protein that we can deliver into the human body so that the human body produces a lot more spike protein to raise antibodies to it. Well, that's the theory. And it was meant to stay in the deltoid muscle. But this substance, it was never going to stay there. If you understand biological systems and lipids, they'll seek out and they'll travel all around the body and they'll go to the fatty parts of the body, which is the central nervous system. I'm bewildered that any doctor or technologist who understands this would take something like this in the first place.
How do you explain that?
I can't. Bewilders me that doctors will inject something without knowing much about the substance than what they're being told, that it's safe and effective. And
it's a huge risk to take.
It is. We've put so much trust in Big Pharma that we will accept anything they tell us.
It's amazing. And I read, speaking of Big Pharma, that Australia's medicine regulatory body, the TGA, receives 96% of its funding from the pharmaceutical industry. Yes. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It started back in 1989. So that Big Pharma pays for the costs of the TGA.
And that's what's called conflict of interest for people who are not aware. This is the classic example of conflict of interest. Yeah. They're the ones telling us what to put into our body when they are being funded by the same companies who are making money on those products.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a simple fact and people are just not aware of that.
Well, people are not aware of the fact either that their complementary medicines, their natural health products, are also regulated by the TGA.
Mm.
And therefore, the TGA has control over the complementary medicines that we can have in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many, many very valuable medicines, complementary natural health products, that we can't have here.
For example?
There are things like nettokinase, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a registered healthcare product here. So people have to import it from overseas.
Are they allowed to?
They can import it. Okay. Yes, they can.
They can import it, but they cannot sell it here.
Can't sell it for your own personal use.
Okay.
People were importing hydroxychloroquine.
And that's very important for a vaccine injured now?
Yes, yes, absolutely. For people who are continuing to produce spike protein, absolutely, because it actually cleaves up the spike protein, breaks it up into amino acids or peptides. Mm-hmm. There's some risk of that as well, but I mean, it's far better to try and do that rather than let spike protein continue to aggravate the immune system. People were importing ivermectin. Sooner or later, the customs discovered that some companies from India were sending ivermectin here, and so that they put a stop to that.
Now it's back? Now it's possible again? Oh, not yet?
Not really, no.
Ah.
The doctors are too frightened to prescribe.
Okay,
The doctors in Queensland were told you go to jail for 6 months if you prescribe ivermectin for somebody with
wow.
Yeah. Clive Palmer imported millions of doses of hydroxychloroquine. They impounded that and destroyed it. I've argued for a long time because we should have a separate regulator for natural health products and keep them away from Big Pharma, because the Big Pharma influence is unbelievably powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not political, but you know, if you're going to try and get something done, you've got to do something yourself. So I joined the Liberal Party, and I used to pay big money, you know, to go to private dinners with mostly ministers of health, but also prime ministers.
Why would you need to pay to go to the?
Because
that's how you get in.
That's when you get in. That's what they do.
It's all about money.
It's all about money. And I can tell you, Efrat, I went to dinners with health ministers where around the table you've got the Beer, Wine and Spirits, British Tobacco, Philip Morris, pathologists, Medicines Australia, always Pfizer. I've overheard conversations with the previous health minister. He's here. I'm here. His chief of staff is here and Mr. Pfizer's there. Chief of staff saying, Don't worry, Mr. Pfizer. I'll make sure that the minister signs off on it tomorrow. I know what your concerns are, but don't worry. I don't know the exact details of it, but it's what happens at these levels. And this is why I come back down to this level to try and teach people about really what's going on, what my experiences are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had dinners with ministers who I thought would do something, in particular female ministers, who I thought, you'll take this on board. We are seeing diabetes. We know that diabetics are deficient in this, that, and the other thing. Let's look at nutritional medicine, give it some support, and get the doctors who are doing this to give support to the doctors who are doing this sort of medicine so we can actually reverse diabetes, which we can with type 2.
No success. Corrupted as well.
Well, they're just too frightened to speak.
Yeah.
Because if you speak up, it's like everything else. You're an outsider. You've become an outsider. You're not in favour of what the medical profession's doing, and that is prescribing drugs and injecting people. Cut, burn and poison is the only thing they can think of.
Yes.
Sorry. Surgery, radiotherapy and chemotherapy. That's the cancer patient treatment. Cut, burn and poison. As soon as you cut, burn or poison, you're producing tissue damage, you're producing inflammation, you're producing substances then that stimulate the cancer cells to grow and develop. Take a cancer patient, make them healthy before you start doing that.
Yeah.
Nutritionally healthy at least, and physically and mentally and spiritually healthy. And then start your activities.
Give it a chance.
The patients who do that do far better.
Wow. Okay. I want to ask you about the COVID measures and what happened here in Victoria, specifically within Australia as well, during COVID, and what does it look like now? Did people forget everything that happened, or is it still around, the results and the after effects?
Well, it was horrific.
Mm-hmm.
Being locked down for the periods of time we were locked down.
It was the most locked down city in the world.
Yeah. Okay. It went on for months and months. And there were seven
different lockdowns. In Israel, I think we had three.
Yeah. Every time there was an increase in the number of PCR test positives, they would say, okay, we've got a problem, so lock them down. And the masking and the plastic shields and the abuse that people were giving to provide each other. Friends separated, families broke down, kids were turned into nuts. The behaviour was with some children. The learning has been put off. The kids are still backwards as far as the schools are concerned. The hospitals were not full of sick people with COVID. The hospitals, some of them were half empty. Yes, there were elderly people with COVID, but these people were sick because their vitamin D levels were low, their vitamin C levels were low, they didn't have any zinc in their system. These are the things that actually fight viruses and help us. If you've got a healthy mucus, the virus can't attach, and the healthy mucus is dependent on vitamin D.
Yeah.
It's the skin inside your body, just like the skin on the outside mm-hmm. of your body. It needs light to produce vitamin D, and the vitamin D takes the light into the system, and it operates on our genes and gives our immune system the most powerful molecules to fight bacteria, viruses and fungi. You know, they locked us up. We couldn't even go out for vitamin D. I mean, even third world countries like El Salvador, the government there promoted outdoor activities. Advertisements go out, get some sunlight.
Don't get me started about El Salvador. It's one of the only places in the world that I dream of living in one day. So it's amazing what you said. I didn't know that he did that, B. Keller.
Yeah.
Well done that he did that.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware. Okay.
Yeah. So our hospitals, our nurses were set if they asked any questions about when the vaccines came.
Yes.
Why wait for vaccines when we had something that we could have done and got natural immunity, which is the most powerful, profound and long-lasting immunity you can achieve by getting the infection? Most of us would have got the infection via mild cold or flu-like illness. They needed to create the pandemic.
The pandemic
Of a virus that was partly manufactured. Absolutely, there's no amount of evidence now that you can say is not strong enough. I mean, the evidence is powerful. It's overwhelming that Fauci, who I had dealings with in the early HIV/AIDS days because he was poisoning people with AZT, I was taking him off AZT and putting him on nutrients and keeping him alive was keeping full-blown AIDS patients alive for up to 9 years when they were given about 11 months to live.
Yeah.
He's one captured individual,
mm-hmm.
totally captured. And he believes his own lies. He believes that he knows everything about immunology, and he knows very little about immunology. And he's taken that organization, National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease in the US, down the wrong path. It is in the deepest, darkest parts of the scientific jungle that needs to be brought out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so do all of the doctors who've been involved in that in the US. And they need to separate it from the military, and they need to separate it from Big Pharma. But whether they can do that in the US, I think there's only one chance, and that's probably Robert F.
Robert F. Kennedy.
Kennedy
Jr. So let's see what happens. So if I bring you back to Australia and Melbourne,
yeah.
and what happened here
yeah.
during COVID, do you think that now, like, what does it look like now? People are forgetting about it, don't want to talk about it, want to pretend it never happened, or is it still
quite excessive
alive in their consciousness?
Yeah. Well, we're seeing excessive unexplained deaths in younger groups.
Mm-hmm.
And these deaths are now becoming normalized as
yes.
if the young people die
yes.
Or get these diseases. And we know that it's far above what should be expected, up to 40% of cardiac problems in some demographics, which is unbelievable.
Yes.
And we have at the WOW people who work in cardiology who've told me that your children are being referred for echocardiograms and ECGs.
And that's not normal.
No. And we're listening to cardiologists saying, well, people die.
We have some kids also dying in Israel that
yeah.
There's an article in the paper and we move on.
Hmm.
No one's talking about it. Kids are dying.
Yeah.
Why? Since yeah. when kids have heart attacks yeah. and well, very bizarre.
We've got to come back to the damage that's been done economically as well,
mm-hmm.
Because science and medicine are things that we can debate about, but the economy has been badly destroyed. And I'm putting it back on the lockdowns.
Yes.
The number of shops in the busy shopping centres in Melbourne, in Chapel Street, in Hampton Street, shops and businesses closing all the time. Bay Street, North Brighton, there's a whole block of shops nearly empty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just continuing. People can't afford food, rent, build a house.
Cost of living is skyrocketing. Inflation.
And this was caused by Mr. Morrison and Mr. Albanese
mm-hmm.
and their governments.
Printing money during COVID.
Printing money. Well, printing money is worthless if you've got no assets to back it, isn't it? That's my thoughts.
Well, that's the fiat system.
Yeah.
Yes. Excessively printing money.
Behavior on the roads. The people I know, the older people I know, are deteriorating very rapidly, and some of them up in institutions and or dying very quickly. One of my friends, he's younger than I am, he goes to a car club, and in 1 month, six of his friends in the car club died.
Ugh.
And they're not old and sick people. The psychiatric issues that I'm seeing, people getting angry and
yes.
disturbed, mood disturbances, behavioral problems,
mm-hmm.
relationship issues when there were no real relationship issues.
Yes.
I would say there is a psychopathy occurring, and it's a toxic psychopathy. A healthy brain is a brain that's free of toxins and is well nourished.
Yes.
A sick brain is poisoned and or lacking nutrients, you know.
Do you think it has something to do with the vaccine?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Not just with the mental state of people from after this long, hard period. Also with the substance itself.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when you look at holistic medicine, holistic yes. healthcare, yes, agree. All of these factors play a role,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. But there are some triggers that really do fire off issues. And one of my colleagues in the States a long time ago had a, I'll give you an example, microbiome can influence if the toxins in the gut go up the vagus nerve into the brain, has an adverse effect on the brain, can actually accelerate dementias and so on. He showed quite clearly in a guy who murdered somebody after mowing the lawns that this guy was not a murderer. He had actually inhaled some of the chemicals in the motor mower And those chemicals actually shut down a particular part of his brain.
Wow.
And they showed that by getting him to inhale these chemicals and looking under an MRI scan, that there was parts of the brain that actually shut down. And these were the parts that are involved in behavior and socialization, but mainly behavior.
So you attribute some of those behaviors or mental states to the substances that people have taken during this time.
Yeah.
Especially the ones that have been taking it 3 and 4 and five times.
Absolutely.
I mean, and it's not yet being investigated.
Not being investigated. I mean, we were destroying young people's brains.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been doing that for quite some time with vaccines. And what's that word you used before? It starts with A?
What
is it?
Yes. Yeah, why is everyone so careful about saying that there might be a connection between them?
I'm trying to be like everybody else. Mm. It's my way.
I'm obviously not a scientist, not a doctor, but allowing myself to say that this needs to be investigated.
It does.
I have personal friends. In fact, a very close friend of mine that has an autistic son. After 3 kids, it's her 4th out of 6 kids. And both her and her husband say that for the first month that the baby was born, he was great. He was smiling. He was communicative.
Yes.
He was making eye contact. And then they went to do, after 1 month that he was born, they went to do another vaccine. And the day after, it's a different kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's autistic, you know. And she said, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I just know that my son is autistic because of this vaccine.
Yes.
Because it happened one day after I took him, and he was a completely different child for 1 month before.
Well,
developing normally before that.
Yeah. It's good that she's made that observation, because she is another mother who can join all the other mothers who've made that observation as well. Because only by making observations can we actually apply the science. But we shouldn't be doing the vaccines in the first place, number one. Most of the childhood illnesses can be prevented with the CD zincs and the cod liver oil, all of the nutrients that used to be used. But if we're going to continue vaccinations, then we've got to be careful about what we're doing and what we're looking at. When a child immediately after develops abnormalities, that's fine. But the child that has a sore arm and has a fever and then gets over it, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, or a month later, or 2 months later, they start to deteriorate. It's again triggered by the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a delayed response, and that's the autism. With the others, you're stimulating IgG and IgM by injecting. You're not stimulating the IgA that protects you. It's that binds the mucus of your nose and your throat and the other parts of your system. And that's why there is a problem, because if the child is, say, for example, immunized against measles, they've got IgG and IgM, immunoglobulins, antibodies, to the measles virus. However, measles virus is out there, and when there is measles virus out there and that child gets the measles virus going into the system, it goes straight into the system. It's like a castle. If you've got the walls of the castle, a moat of the castle, and the drawbridge up and the gate closed, viruses can't get in. But if you've got no IgA, and therefore the walls are weak, the gates are open, there's no moat left, the virus, the enemy goes in, all of a sudden you've got enemy going in, and there's confusion, because the immune system or the soldiers inside can't recognize the enemy, because the enemy hasn't been labeled with IgA on its way in. So it's confusion, and you end up with soldiers in the fort with sticks fighting a virus or an invader that's got bows and arrows. It's a very simplistic way of putting it.
No, not efficient at all.
Not efficient at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the measles goes in there, and you end up not with a measles, but you end up with a disturbance in the lung, and you end up with a child with asthma, or you're going to end up with a disturbance in the central nervous system, and a child develops epilepsy. And this is what's been happening. We know that populations of children who've been vaccinated and over-vaccinated are far unhealthier than populations of children who are either not vaccinated or very slightly vaccinated.
Ooh, And we encourage more investigation on that. I want to ask you about cannabis and psilocybin treatments, an area that you've been handling and operating in the last few years. When did you start and what do you see? How do you see this area developing?
I started supporting cannabis when I was a long time ago in the psychiatric hospital because we're getting people coming in with addictions to alcohol and heroin. And we're detoxing them with IV nutrients and massage and diet and so on. And it was a Roman Catholic hospital, so that the nuns were very much on my side because they thought that my treatments were closer to that rather than the shock treatment, the drugs that the patients were getting. So to help them through their anxieties, we discovered that some of them were getting cannabis and going out the back and smoking. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, let them do that. That's fine. As long as they don't go back on the heroin, we keep them and we try to wean them down from the cannabis as well. And that was, I mean, using high dose intravenous vitamin C and other nutrients, you can actually wean people off the drugs. So that was the start of my interest in it.
You managed to completely get them to stop using?
We'd get them off heroin. We'd get people off alcohol,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Entirely?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. As long as you set up the psychosocial system that will support them.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires, you know, a reasonably well-off middle-class home. Those who could not afford it, unfortunately, you know, it was not possible. And we couldn't attract that many people into a private hospital. Mm-hmm. This is what I think is wrong with our whole system.
Yeah, if this was a public system, then people would be able to enjoy that kind of treatment.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's a very, very unfair system. But then later on, I got to know Olivia Newton-John, and she was became a good friend. And when she married her recent husband, Amazon John or John Easterling, he calls himself Amazon John because most of the time he spends in the Amazon of plant medicine.
And he's wow,
a real nice character. Mm-hmm. He married Olivia without even knowing that she was a famous singer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When he met her, he hadn't realized who she was. So
how can you not know? Wow.
Well, he's an interesting person.
Okay.
Really nice guy, and spent some time down here. And he introduced me to ayahuasca because that's what they did. She benefited from that with her emotional issues,
yes,
cancers and so forth. So I got interested in the cannabis, and he was providing Olivia with the cannabis. He was growing it in St. Ynez in the California valleys and providing her with specific strains of the cannabis to help her with her breast cancer,
mm-hmm,
and her well-being. And, you know, he helped us keep her out of
hospitals
and maintained her well-being and health right up until the end. Many years. Would have been 15
wow,
years or more. A few years ago, I saw Olivia and she didn't look well. She was in hospital. And I thought when she went back to California, I think I'd see her again. The next time I saw her, a year later, she'd bounced back incredibly. There are elements of cannabis that I'm going to say are anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer, and pro-life.
Yes.
And it's called the sacred plant, and there are reasons for it being called the sacred plant, because it is a marvelous substance if it's used properly.
Mm-hmm.
Either as the oil or as just inhaling the nebulized flower, mm-hmm, from a nebulizer, not burning and smoking it. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm supporting.
Okay.
And there are so many different strains and species of cannabis with all the different cannabinoids. There's 142 plus cannabinoids.
Wow.
Not just CBD or THC. There's so many others, and you know we're discovering how powerful they are.
And our brain has the receptors for it, right?
Our whole system has receptors.
We are designed
to take it. We are designed to take it because, number one, we've got receptors for cannabinoids. Number two, we actually produce our own cannabinoids.
Wow.
One is called 2-AG, and the other is called anandamide.
Okay.
Anandamide, after the Indian word meaning bliss. So anandamide and 2-AG we make in our own central nervous system, mm-hmm, and we therefore our neurons talk to one another. But not only talk to one another, they talk to the immune system because the immune cells have got cannabinoid receptors as well.
Okay.
Our skin cells have them as well.
Wow.
So there's this constant, powerful communicating system of endocannabinoids that if we don't produce enough or got an imbalance of them,
mm-hmm.
We need them from external sources.
So with your experience, you've seen effective treatment with cannabinoids, different types of them, for violence, for drugs, for what else? Cancer?
For every human condition, because that's what we have. We've got an endocannabinoid system. I'm not treating your PTSD or your cancer or your anxiety or your migraine headaches or your epilepsy. I'm treating your endocannabinoid system. I'm balancing your endocannabinoid system. I need more research being done on all of these cannabinoids so that we can design more plants that are more specific to your requirements.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And is that the direction it's going? Is research underway?
There's some fantastic research being done in Israel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A gentleman by the name of Didi Meyer, Google him. He's doing research with cancer and looking at strains of cannabis,
mm-hmm.
And their action against prostate cancer, I think probably other cancers by now. But this is worldwide research.
Yes.
There's so much being done.
But it's going in the right direction in terms of cannabis.
Yes, yes.
At least that is something good and hopeful that we can come up with. You know, in this discussion, because we're talking about pharma and what are the dark paths it's leading us to, and then we see something completely different with the cannabis.
You're right.
Use and research.
Yeah. You're asking the right questions, hopefully giving you the right answers. Imagine we get the young children and re-educate them as to what nature can do or what God can do to make you healthy. Physically, mentally, and spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, your children and your children's children, because mm-hmm. we cannot continue to go down the pathway that we've taken. The building blocks, we've got the building blocks. We know that they're there. They've been there for eons. It's just that our hubris, our ignorance, our arrogance, the negative aspect of our humanity has taken over from where we should be. Hey?
And that technocratic path we're going in, looking at a human being as a structure holding data and trying to extract data out of us for the sake of someone's technology, rather than looking at the miracle that this is a creature of creation of God that has so much potential and so much that we can learn. Still, we know nothing. We hardly know anything about what God has given us or this world has given us, that we can treat ourselves and heal and prosper. We know nothing, and we think that we've cracked it all with pharma and data, with pharma and technology. And I come from technology. I know how powerful it can be, but how also dangerous it can be when we harness it to the wrong direction or in the wrong hands. So I think we're really at this interesting crossroads right now of understanding the damage and the risks while seeing the potential and the vision in the alternatives that, you know, you have dedicated your life to. And I think a lot of education is missing around that.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I'm analog. I'm not data. I'm not digital. I'm not data. But you get a lot of data out of me. How you interpret that data, that's that's most important. Technology has gone so far ahead. Science and technology have gone so far ahead. Majority of the population don't understand it, and that includes our leaders.
Yes.
And therefore, there's a disparity that needs to be corrected. And I think the more we learn, the less we know. You know, I would like, for example, to have a super quantum computer to look at all of the genes that we have, all of the natural molecules that are out there and their relationships, because by doing that, we can actually make our good genes behave better, and we can downregulate or switch off our bad genes. And we know trillions right now, but there are trillions of combinations and permutations that exist.
So I admit that I was worried and hesitant, and I asked you a question when we had coffee the other day about manipulating the human genome. And I think about it and I look at it, and I studied genetics when I was in high school and I loved it. I was fascinated. I took biology as my master. But looking at it now, after the 25 years that passed and everything I've seen with pharma and where it's going and biotechnology, etc., I'm quite worried on where they're going to take the manipulation of the human genome. And then you told me, in a way, trying to comfort me, we are manipulating our genome anyway, all the time, with the food we eat, with the sun. I would like you to speak a little bit about that, about manipulating our DNA and our genome, and how can that be done in a non-intrusive or harmful or dangerous way to benefit the human?
Very, very simply, we can take a methylating agent such as semi-S-adenosylmethionine, or another agent like N-acetylcysteine, and we can cysteinate or methylate certain parts of our genome, and that will downregulate or upregulate the genes. Mm-hmm. We need to know what we're doing more specifically, but we know they are chemical reactions that do occur at the genetic level from things that we can take into our system. When we look at foods, for example, there are sulfides in garlic and onions that actually get into the nucleus of the cell and influence the genes. There are other things like the curcumins and that will actually from turmeric, which have an influence on the genes. We know that there are many, many receptors in the body for vitamin D. The active form of vitamin D goes into the nucleus of our cells and has an effect on the genes and the expression of the genes. And that's when we start producing the proteins called antibodies.
So all that is natural, and it happens anyway. Right.
So where
do we take this and manipulate it or abuse it?
Well,
when does that start?
The abuse occurs when we take a chemical or a drug or medicine, and take radiotherapy, or we start producing inflammatory responses in the body. This is when we are messing around with the balance of chemicals. We call them anti-inflammatories and pro-inflammatory substances, carcinogens and carcinogenic substances. There are a whole range of chemicals involved in these reactions that we can downregulate with natural approaches. And if something goes haywire, the first thing you do, I believe, is rest.
Right.
And you start talking to yourself or speaking out loud about positive things, positive affirmations, because that is genomic as well. We talk about epigenetics, and that's what we've been talking about, the influence of the environment and nutrients and on our genes. And the repair of our genes, we need zinc and selenium, trace elements, to help the enzymes repair our genes. This is all happening
all the time,
millions of times a second in every cell and tissue in our body. Mm-hmm. So you only have to do something very small to make yourself feel better. And build on that, no matter how sick you are, build on it. And there are always going to be reactions in your body that are adverse to your biochemistry. And these reactions generally involve electro changes in cells functioning. When that happens, you have electrons. They are the simple negative charges in the body that misbehave. And when you have electrons doing that, you have what's called free radicals in the system. And most people know that free radicals are mopped up by antioxidants, and the most powerful antioxidant is, in terms of the human and the human requirements during stress and illness, is vitamin C. It's ubiquitous. It can get into every nook and cranny of every cell and tissue in your body, virtually, almost, and mop up these damaging radicals. Mm-hmm. So as soon as somebody gets a deadly virus, I say, if you're in Africa with Ebola, or whether you're in some other part of the world where there's Zika, if you end up with a symptoms that you've got a viral illness, intravenous vitamin C straight away. And that's my teaching for all of the doctors around.
There is also there. It's working.
It's there and it works.
So let's talk about psilocybin.
Psilocybin.
I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
It's an amazing a discovery.
Yeah.
I mean, I have experienced it and it opened my consciousness completely. I think that from the moment I used it once, I never went back to being the same way I was before.
Yeah.
Something has changed after I had, you know, taken mushrooms, and psilocybin is magical in the way I have experienced it. It was always with a spiritual experience as well when I had experienced it. And the first time I had tried it, I said, wow, all of that was available for me. And I had never seen it before, tried it before, experienced it before. That is a miracle. And so what does psilocybin actually do to us? What does it enable? What does it allow?
That's a great question. What do you think it does?
I think that it brings us back to nature. It shows us that we are part of Earth.
Yes.
That we are part of this magical system.
Yes.
And creates a lot of humbleness, kind of bring us down, not just physically down to Earth, but like spiritually down to Earth.
Yeah.
It makes us appreciate everything a lot more. That's what I experienced when I had the privilege of taking it, and magical things happened to me when I tried it.
You had a magical mystery tour.
Yeah, I had amazing trips, and I not only experienced things and heard things and saw things, but also physically in nature where I was, magical things happened. Like all of a sudden these animals came out and plants talked to me in a different way, and you know, Earth just showed itself up to me, and it was always there. I never saw it that way before.
Yeah.
And I can see it again without taking any mushrooms afterwards.
You have any cautions?
Yes, always do this with people that you trust in a very safe setting.
Quiet,
relaxing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a party.
No, it's not.
At all.
That's when the bad trips.
It's not a party drug.
No.
It's not even, I can't call it a drug. It's not
it's
a
not,
drug. It's
no.
an experience.
No, it's, you're right. It's
for me, it was a healing experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't a party thing at all.
No, it's not. They're not meant to be that.
Mm-hmm.
It's to connect you again with the reality.
Yes.
The earth reality. And when you look at mushrooms, they have mycelia that spread everywhere, right across the forest floor.
Mm-hmm.
You're connecting with all of that. You might not think so, but you are. From an esoteric perspective, it's reconnecting you with everything. We are all connected.
Mm-hmm.
We're connected completely through electromagnetic forces, electrostatic forces, and probably other forces that we are not even aware of. But we are all connected, and we have to start appreciating that. And you take this is from a physics perspective, you take an electron at one end of the universe and start spinning it. Its partner electron at the other end of the universe will start spinning in the opposite direction.
Quantum reality.
It's a quantum reality. So, and that's a reality too.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we like to be able to analyze and break things down and try to understand them. And when it comes back to psilocybin, MDMA, and these other psychoactive substances, we try to find out what's happening in the brain, and that's fine. But it's not just the brain where it's working. Yeah, we can find the connections between the memory part of the brain and the emotional part of the brain. There are changes in those when people undergo psilocybin, and that's been seen on scans. That's why we understand that, but that's only a very, very small part of what these magic chemicals. They are there for people who be creative as well, because it really brings the creativity back. You don't need AI.
I mean, it can help.
It can help, yeah.
Yeah, but we're far more creative.
If you're going to do AI, do it with some MDMA or psilocybin.
Wow, that would be an experience. Writing with AI, mushroom. Okay, so what can we do with psilocybin? How can we help people with psilocybin?
I'd like to see more research being done, especially with healthy people, as well as people with a whole range of illnesses, in particular the aging disorders. I think we can help a lot of people with that serious emotional problems. And I do believe that there's a relationship between emotions being held in and cancers and other serious autoimmune disease, but definitely cancers. Cancer patients hold their emotions in. If we can separate the memories and the emotions and give them some good trips, I think we will be doing them a great service.
I am sure that psilocybin can assist with trauma healing.
Yeah.
And I've seen people creating amazing results by undergoing some psilocybin treatments with traumas. And it's been investigated for years and years, back in the 70s in the US, and they stopped it, right? Yeah. And is it coming back now?
It's coming back.
It's coming back.
Yeah, coming back. The research is being done here. But I remember one of my psychiatrists back when I was at Prince Henry's Hospital in Melbourne.
Yes.
He was doing work with LSD.
LSD.
We had a meeting here with Mind Medicine Australia. I've given some lectures for Mind Medicine Australia. I'm on their board. They had a function here for the psychiatrists and the doctors just to open up their minds to it. And there was a woman from the Ukraine who'd been seriously traumatized by the war in the Ukraine. And she was catatonic in what a schizophrenic is, basically can't do anything, can't move, can't talk. And she went through two trips, and she was up on the stage telling everybody how wonderful she felt. She'd never felt like that ever in her whole life. And she could still remember the trauma of the war, but she didn't have the emotional responses to it, and she could speak about it clearly. I think this is unbelievable healthcare.
Yes.
It's not medicine. It's real. It's real healthcare. It's looking after people. That was one of the most profound case histories that I've come across. Medicinal cannabis courses have been running for quite some time now. We started about 6 years ago when it was first made legal. Access to medicinal cannabis is very, very difficult still. They have to have a prescription from a doctor because of the current health department's regulations. We were Les, who I introduced medicinal cannabis to, who helped to start the first cannabis courses, has moved on to psychedelics. And she's a researcher, a professor of traditional Chinese medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And she's moving into this arena of psychedelics. So I'm following her.
So, Ian, this is, you're taking me exactly where I wanted to go with finishing off this beautiful discussion that we have, but also planting some seeds of hope for the future, because I'm looking at your life's work and I'm looking at everything that you are touching. There are so many areas that you have covered, just inspiring other people to go off and explore and branch off. But you have devoted your life to exploring areas that normally doctors will not explore, that the health system will not go to, that traditional medicine will not touch, that the powers that be will not encourage people to go and educate themselves in, because it contradicts some of their agendas or interests. And these are all the pathways that you have always taken and you have always explored, which is fascinating and incredible in my eyes. And I think you have touched a lot of people and made a significant difference during your life by doing that. How do you think that humanity is going to continue to evolve when we have powers and forces that are taking us down a certain path, while we already know, that the other path that you have explored throughout your life is so incredible, is so effective and marvelous, and there is so much to be benefited from? Where do you think humanity is going with those two paths, that they are in many ways contradicting? Like, we are allowing those people, for example, to regulate nature, to say what is legal or illegal in terms of nature that has been here so much longer than we have and that is so much smarter than we are. So there's this path that's taking us a certain way, and then there's this path that is saying, here I am, nature, in all its glory. Learn from me, take from me, work with me. I can give you all that miracle. Where do we go? Where does humanity go? I know it's a big question.
I think you've already answered it, Ephra.
I don't know if I don't have the answer. See both timelines. I see both pathways possible.
Yeah.
Where does humanity go?
One will succeed and the other will fail. And we'll continue to go down these pathways until the wrong way starts failing and failing more and more and more. And I think more and more people are starting to realize that the world is not all about big medicine, big pharma, big food, big industry. We are inherently peaceful, loving individuals. We are gregarious by nature. We are social animals. Mm-hmm. We enjoy other people's company. We are re-educating ourselves to some extent, and that's been my whole raison d'etre, is to continue to talk to people and educate, and hopefully others will do the same. And I've seen a massive change in Australia with regard to doctors' attitudes with the colleges and the associations that we've set up. More and more doctors are coming across and realizing that they've not been able to help all of their patients the way they would like to help them. And many of them have been sick themselves and discovering other ways. When I started doing nutritional medicine, there were no vitamins in the pharmacies. There were no worthwhile vitamins in the supermarket. The health food stores had primitive nutrients in them. Blackmores, one of Australia's biggest companies, Mr. Blackmore, who I knew personally, said, we will never go into pharmacy because we are pure and we're going to stay in health food stores. But you know, they ended up going into pharmacy. They ended up going into grocery and supermarkets. Mm-hmm. And so there is that influence there. And the supermarkets are now putting organic foods in some parts of their stores, mm-hmm. which means there is a shift in people's attitudes. Yes. And I think that we need a catalyst every now and again to open up people's minds. And I think the COVID has been a catalyst for a lot of people.
Yes.
Not everybody. A lot of people still believe that there was a dangerous virus that was going to cause a pandemic and 50% of the people would die. We've got to keep on educating people that they were lies created by an industry that was profiting from them, and that's why they're suffering now with inflation and poverty. So it's just keeping the story going, and that's why you're here, and that's why I'm here. You know, you've changed your career pathway. In fact, it's a significant pathway.
Seeing that that's happening.
I see it's happening, mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes. Hopefully some of the litigation that's occurring around the world will start having an effect on big pharma and big food. So we see changes in those areas, and everybody, including the farmers, have to resist the forces of evil,
yes,
coming from the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation,
their Gavi,
CEPI, all of these organizations, and realize that they've been brainwashed by the four or five major media outlets in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The brainwashing continues with our national broadcaster here. In an unbelievable way, it's a catalyst for more death and disease. As far as I'm concerned, the ABC is not fulfilling its responsibility as a national broadcaster anymore. I'm fearful about the messages that are coming out of the ABC. I'm fearful about the messages being delivered to children at schools at the moment.
Yes,
these are things that we have to keep educating people about. I did an interview. A talk for the Doctors for COVID Medical Ethics, and there was a Roman Catholic priest speaking about major issues and the world control by evil governments, single world control by an evil cabal of elites who, if they ever listen to this or hear about me I'm not afraid of them at all. Mm-hmm. They are people or individuals or organisms that I don't count as being a part of humanity. And the evil, the greatest evil, is the pedophilia and the human trafficking, especially of the 1 million to 10 million children around the world. That is something that has to come to an end and has to be exposed. Maybe some of these issues around Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Gates, Clinton, and all of the others will start to reveal some of the truths that are going on at the highest levels, so-called highest levels, at the deepest, darkest parts of our existence.
I'm aware that in Australia there are some pedophiles that are being protected by courts to not reveal their identities. The same thing, the exact same thing is happening in Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
They have 30 pedophiles that their names are being concealed by the courts.
Yes.
And their identities are not revealed, but we know that they are high-powered individuals.
Yeah.
In public figures, some of them politicians, and they're not being disclosed. And yet this thing has to be brought into daylight so that people are aware of what kind of people are running the show.
Running the show.
Mm-hmm.
The elites, they're protecting themselves.
Yeah.
And they compromise our leaders. And that's the situation that we're in. And, to me, natural justice is more powerful and profound than human justice.
Mm-hmm.
Natural justice will see
Yeah.
the truth. We've got to have the courage to reveal the truth as much as we possibly can.
Continue to speak out.
Yeah, because without truth, there's no other. Somebody once said, there's no other virtue.
So, Ian, where can people follow you, find you, and follow your work?
Well, right now, the organization called the World of Wellness Limited is the organization that I'm working with. We've got a fantastic group of people on our board, and our supporters are fantastic, and we're very, very active. We've only been going for less than 18 months. Have a look there. They can also follow me on my Substack.
You're doing great work on Substack. I follow you, and
thank you.
I encourage people to subscribe.
Yeah, well, I follow you too, and encourage people to subscribe as well, because your material is absolutely terrific. You're talking about things that I don't know very much about.
Well, I try to bring them to light.
Well, you do it very well, and I think that's a reflection of your experience in the area of international marketing and sending the message.
And just being a curious human being.
Yeah,
I'm just curious about things.
Yeah,
and I the same way I want to reveal lies and show the truth about health, about politics, about wars. I want to do the same about money, so that people know how to take care of themselves in their daily life.
Yeah.
And there is much to reveal. Anything else you want to say as we finish up?
For those who want to do courses, the ACNEM course, Australasian College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, is a top course. Doctors and other healthcare professionals can go right through and get a fellowship. Support the National Institute of Integrative Medicine. They're always calling for a little bit of money for research.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take very much, to a few dollars here and a few dollars there to add up.
Yes.
And in fact, our big study that we did on COVID to show that vitamin D, C and zinc were effective, including getting people out of intensive care very quickly. That was a published study that the government conveniently ignored. And for others who want to join medical organisation, whether they be doctors, nurses or other allied healthcare professionals, they should join the Australian Medical Professionals Society, or AMPS. It's in opposition to the AMA. And the other thing is we run courses at the WOW for people who want to learn about intravenous therapies. One of our senior nurses who was sacked from her job at one of Melbourne's biggest public hospitals has taken on the job of running the courses for training people to do intravenous nutrients, and that's life-saving.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the time, Ian, and for this fascinating conversation. I hope people will find it as fascinating as I did. And thank you for hosting me.
Oh, you're fantastic. Thank you. Thanks for coming to Melbourne.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we must keep in touch.
We'll do more things together in the future. I will be here again.
Fantastic.
Thank you, dear.
Thanks.